Today's episode of Walter Edgar's Journal contains a frank discussion of atrocities committed by Japanese soldiers during the battle for Manila. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is James Scott of Charleston, and he's written a new book, Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila. James, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Who are you and who are your folks and where did you come from and how did you end up in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina?
It's the classic Charleston question. So, I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, and went to school there. And then I went to Wofford for my undergrad. And from there, I ended up at the Rock Hill Herald and as a daily newspaper reporter. Spent a year and a half there and then got a phone call one day from the Post and Courier asking if I wanted to move to Charleston. And said I did. I spent 6 years at the Post and Courier as a newspaper reporter covering City Hall, the military, special projects. And then I received a Nieman Fellowship, went back to school for a year at Harvard, and worked on my first book when I was there and have now written four books.
I was going to say, and your first book was?
The Attack on the Liberty, which was the story of it was actually a very personal story in that the story of my father. He was a young naval officer who was assigned to an American spy ship called the USS Liberty, which was designed as a mobile listening platform. And the Navy and the NSA operated this fleet of ships that were designed to send to hotspots all around the world.
This is the Mediterranean, right?
This was the Mediterranean. And the USS Pueblo, which was captured by the North Koreans shortly thereafter, was another one of the ships from this program. And so the Liberty was sent to the Mediterranean during the Six-Day War in 1967. And the Israelis attacked it. And they hit it with 821 rockets and cannons.
821?
They napalmed it, and then they torpedoed it as well. And my father was, that day, June 8th, 1967, was his 24th birthday. And he was the damage control officer.
Oh, gee.
So he had the job as a young ensign to keep the ship from sinking.
All right. Did you major in history at Wofford?
I was actually English and Spanish. So history was one of my passions. And I had a teacher at Wofford who said, whatever you do, don't major in the thing you love because it'll ruin it for you. So I ended up in English and Spanish and not history, but naturally gravitated back that way as I got older.
Well, so you started in the 1960s and you've gradually worked back.
Exactly.
And your other two titles are?
I did a book called The War Below, which was on the submarine war in the Pacific during World War II. And then I did another book called The Target Tokyo, which was about the Doolittle Raid, which has a big connection here in Colombia. And that was on Jimmy Doolittle, of course, in the attack on Tokyo in April 1942. And then my most recent book is Rampage, which is the Battle of Manila.
The Battle for Manila is an interesting story. I can understand, with the naval connection with your dad, how you did the one about the sub-warfare. But how did you pick out this particular incident?
You're always looking for those stories that haven't been told or what new you can bring to our understanding of history. And, there's so much that's been done on the European theater and a small fraction in the Pacific theater. And so that's the area where I tend to specialize more. And what amazed me is the Battle of Manila was the only urban fight of the entire Pacific War. And it was also one of the bloodiest. It led to about 100,000 civilian deaths. It also led to the first war crimes trial in all of Asia, which ended up going all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Yet there had never before been an American book done on this topic. And so it's just this gaping hole in the scholarship on it.
You mentioned, there have been books on Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima and what have you. But the entire conflict in the Pacific has not been told very much. Mm-hmm. In some cases, not very well.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, there's been a number of books on Midway, Guadalcanal. I mean, those pivotal battles really get a lot of the attention. But, in this case, there had been nothing on Manila. And Manila really, beyond it, the type of battle it was, the urban battle and the heavy civilian loss, there's also a huge American connection to the Philippines during that time period. And a lot of Americans forget that today. But, back then, the Philippines were an American colony.
For readers who don't know much about American history, you do give a brief summary of that. And so let's do that for our listeners.
Okay.
How did we get into the Philippines?
Exactly. We got in during the Spanish-American War. And so Spain had held the Philippines for centuries. And during the Spanish-American War, we got Cuba, and we also got the Philippines from Spain. But we granted Cuba independence, but decided to hang on to the Philippines, and largely because of its great location out there in the Pacific. And as soon as we got the Philippines, it ended up in a huge insurrection in which Douglas MacArthur's father, Arthur, played a role in. He actually helped capture Manila during the Spanish-American War and served as an early military governor. But the Filipinos were really adamant that they wanted independence, self-rule, and the United States wasn't willing to let them have it. So we fought for a couple of years in a very bloody insurrection.
It's interesting, given what happened during that conflict, the Japanese used a lot of the same tools 50 years later.
Yeah, exactly. We waterboarded Filipinos. In fact, Life magazine ran in 1902 on its cover a drawing of American troops waterboarding a Filipino guerrilla. We created concentration camps to sort of herd villagers in there, and we destroyed livestock and villages, all in an effort to pacify the Filipinos. And in the end, we did.
Yeah. There was one commander who sent a unit out. It said, round up all the men of fighting age, anybody 10 or over. Mm-hmm. When you get towards the end of the book, that's exactly what the Japanese were doing.
It totally echoes. What happened in the early 1900s literally echoes again 40 years later when the Japanese come into the Philippines as well.
All right. So once we get past the Philippine insurrection, mm-hmm. as the Army calls it, we as a country pour a lot of money into the Philippines.
Correct.
A lot of Americans move out there. I would say expats, but since they're living in American territory, that's not the case.
No, I mean, the Philippines really, you know, we very quickly saw that it had this amazing location for our business interests. I mean, it was going to be the front door to the markets in India, China, and Malaya. So we got Daniel Burnham, who was the famed municipal planner and architect. I mean, he designed the Flatiron Building in New York, Union Station in Washington. He's the one who came up with Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. We sent him out to the Philippines and said, help us build Manila into a city that best reflects America. And so he did. And so he designed a city. And over the course of those four decades, Manila really blossomed into this American city in Asia. On top of that, you know, all these American businesses, Westinghouse, Studebaker, Ford, B.F. Goodrich, all of them sent employees over there and have that footprint in the islands. So you had a huge American population living there as well, business executives as well as American military population. So Manila really became a small slice of America in Asia during that time period. And a lot of people were attracted to the low cost of life. I mean, Americans that lived over there could afford housekeepers and cooks and drivers and things. And so it was the trade-off was it was hot and it was humid, but at the same time, it was a lower cost of living and an easier pace of life.
Although, as you note, some of the better addresses in Manila had air conditioning. Mm-hmm. Now, that really was a luxury.
Oh, absolutely.
That could tell you the style into which some people, including General MacArthur, were.
Oh, absolutely. He lived in the atop the Manila Hotel, which is this grand hotel. It's still there today, and an air-conditioned penthouse suite. And the air conditioners at that time actually, they really only had one setting. And the ones in his apartment were actually so cold that Jean MacArthur, his wife, actually used portable heaters to counterbalance the air conditioning system.
And you've got some wonderful photographs before and after. This great 19th century Beaux-Arts, the big columns, all the mm-hmm. public buildings. There was an equivalent to Rodeo Drive, mm-hmm. you know, with all the luxury shops.
Oh, yeah.
Again, designed for really more for Europeans than for Filipinos. Mm-hmm. Because although we've never said as a country we've been an imperial power, that's the way we behaved in the Philippines.
Absolutely. It certainly was. It was our colony. Yeah.
Although this was not true of MacArthur's father or MacArthur, most Americans there did not treat Filipinos as equal. They treated them as folks that were lesser, mm-hmm. banned them from the social clubs and what have you.
Exactly. It was a very similar social structure that we had in the United States at that time. I mean, you had, for instance, you had hotels and restaurants that served only the American population and not the Filipinos. I mean, they actually built a golf course there just so that the Filipinos would have a place to play because most of the golf courses catered to the Americans. So you did. You had that social inequality there in the Philippines that you saw in the American South at that time as well.
And you've got several sad commentaries on here these Filipino families who are beautifully educated, mm-hmm. wealthy, cosmopolitan, and they're denied at restaurants or mm-hmm. they're presence is questioned.
And they don't get the nice tables in the restaurants that do allow them. You know, they're seated farther back from the dance floor, for instance, in the nightclubs, or they don't get to eat in some of the fine dining establishments.
Or you get the table by the kitchen door.
Exactly.
And so Douglas MacArthur, everybody's pretty much familiar out there with Douglas MacArthur, sort of grows up, not necessarily in the Philippines, but with Filipino experience through his father.
Absolutely. Well, his father, you know, had been, like I said, had helped capture Manila during the Spanish-American War, had served as an early military governor there in the Philippines. And then MacArthur, his first posting after he graduated from West Point in 1903, was to the Philippines as well. And he served repeatedly in the islands. He kept coming back, you know, year after year and in positions of greater prominence so that he really developed these close ties with a lot of the folks in the Philippines who would go on to become their senior political and business leaders. It's important to remember, too, you know, he'd grown up a military brat. His father had traveled all over, you know, the United States and the world. And so for MacArthur, I mean, Manila really became kind of the closest thing he had to a hometown. He felt very comfortable there. He felt very comfortable with the people. His mother died in Manila. He met his wife and courted her there. His son was born there. So really, for MacArthur, Manila was home.
And he went back in the 1930s, really working for the Filipino government.
Correct. He had finished up his job as America's top soldier's chief of staff and had been invited over to help the Philippines prepare a modern army with the expectation that they would get their independence in the 1940s. And so he agreed, moved back over in 1935, lived atop the Manila Hotel. He lived there all the way up until the outbreak of World War II. And so so for MacArthur, you know, when the war actually begins, you know, he can actually see the smoldering ruins of Cavite Naval Base or the bombing attacks on the old walled city in Manila, all from his terrace. And so for MacArthur, when the war begins, he's really on the front lines of America's war with Japan.
Everybody remembers Pearl Harbor, but other American possessions in the Pacific were being attacked at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, and Pearl Harbor is really just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the Japanese went on to take Guam from the United States, the Philippines, Wake Island. They took Hong Kong and Singapore from the British, the Dutch East Indies from the Netherlands. I mean, literally in just a few short months, the Japanese built this empire that stretched across one-tenth of the globe. And so Pearl Harbor is just one component of that whole early campaign by the Japanese.
We need to pause for a moment, James, and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with James Scott about his recent book, Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila.
Today's episode of Walter Edgar's Journal contains a frank discussion of atrocities committed by Japanese soldiers during the battle for Manila. Listener discretion is advised.
I think our story really starts up. You talk about MacArthur from his terrace there atop the Manila Hotel, seeing the damaged American naval base across the way. That's quickly followed up by the landing of a Japanese army in the Philippines.
Correct, yes. The Japanese invade very, very quickly, right, when the war begins. And MacArthur, there in Manila, you know, is a population of over 600,000 people, and he realizes that he doesn't want there to be a huge fight in the city. And the city at that time was known as the Pearl of the Orient. It was such a nice place. And so he wanted to spare Manila. So he orders the evacuation of his forces out of the city over to the Bataan Peninsula and the fortified island of Corregidor, which is really the top of an old volcano about 27 miles out in the bay. And he declares Manila an open city, which means it's a city that essentially he's taking it off of the battlefield.
Now, say we're talking in a world where there were, quote, rules of warfare.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's exactly.
I just want people to understand, because this concept of an open city goes back to European conflict, 17th century.
Yeah, you move all your military goods out and your army out, and you want to leave the civilian population alone. And that was at the forefront of MacArthur's ideas at this point, was how do we save Manila? I mean, it's this beautiful city. It's, like I said, it's filled with 600,000 civilians. You know, it doesn't need to be destroyed in an unnecessary battle. So he takes his forces and heads out to Bataan and Corregidor. And what then begins is a grind as the Japanese just slowly wear down the American and Filipino troops all the way up until March of 1942, when MacArthur is eventually ordered by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, to have to evacuate the Philippines, really to rob the Japanese of a propaganda victory of capturing one of America's great generals.
You have kind of a mixed view of him throughout the book, which I think is historically accurate. The famous comment of, I shall return. Mm-hmm. But when he left, a lot of the GIs who had to stay there and fight weren't real happy about the general in the cave.
No, I mean, they felt throughout the entire time he was there, he only visited the Bataan Peninsula one time. He spent the rest of the time on Corregidor. And a lot of that, you know, in the big tunnel system that the Americans had built there into the rock. And so when he left, you know, he escaped with his family and his staff on torpedo boats one night in March. It created a lot of resentment for the troops left behind. They, in fact, had called him Dugout Doug because he was constantly in the tunnels. And then when he left to escape to Australia, a lot of them felt betrayed that he'd abandoned them and left them there to be captured by the enemy, which, of course, is what happened. And that's where, you know, the Bataan Death March, which is a very legendary and brutal occurrence, takes place as a result of all that.
And those soldiers and Navy personnel who had families, their families didn't evacuate. They were interned.
Correct. Yeah. It happened so fast that all the Americans, you know, all these executives and their employees of these American companies who were still living in Manila, the Japanese fanned out through the city, rounded them all up. I mean, literally thousands of them, and put them in a huge internment camp right in Manila at the University of Santo Tomas.
Well, despite all of this, MacArthur was awarded the Medal of Honor. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, after North Africa, Eisenhower was to be awarded it, and he turned it down, even though it was remarked he had earned it.
He turned it down because he once knew of a man who received it for sitting in a hole in the ground, is what he said, being the tunnel there in Corregidor where MacArthur was.
And throughout the war, there's a great deal of antipathy between these two general officers. In fact, MacArthur rejoicing at a setback in Europe. I found this almost unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. There's an incredible pettiness. I mean, and that gets at the heart of who MacArthur was. I mean, he was, on the one hand, he had moments of real genius, and then he had moments of total childhood petulance. He would take joy in the failure of Eisenhower, for instance, or the setbacks of Eisenhower during the Battle of the Bulge. I mean, displayed a lot of the same tendencies that I see out of my 9-year-old at times. And so that's what made him such a complex character.
Okay. All right. So he gets to Australia, and once the United States forces begin their island hopping to get to the home islands over a several-year period, we get to late 1943, and so where the American forces are, do they go into the Philippines or do they pass the Philippines?
Mm-hmm. Correct. And what happens is the Navy is pretty adamant that we should bypass the Philippines and take Taiwan, which back then was called Formosa, because it was closer to Japan and would put us farther up the road toward taking the enemy's homeland. But MacArthur was really adamant that the United States had a moral obligation to go back to the Philippines and also to redeem his promise of I shall return. And so they had this big confrontation between MacArthur and Chester Nimitz in a beachfront mansion in the summer of 1944 in Hawaii, where FDR is essentially the referee between these two as they sort of battle out their strategy. And Nimitz, he advocates that they should bypass the Philippines. And MacArthur makes this moral argument, which is, you know, we said we would come back. They're an American colony. And if we don't come back at the first available opportunity, the Filipino people are going to hold that against us. And he actually then speaks to Roosevelt in the one language FDR really understood, which was politics. Mm-hmm. And he says to him, if we don't go back, the voters in the next election, which was coming up in November 1944, are going to hold this against you.
Actually, I don't think that would have happened.
It wouldn't have. FDR was way too popular. But MacArthur was speaking language he knew FDR understood.
Well, talk about impertinence. So they decide to invade the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And then within a matter of days, he makes an announcement, the battle's over in the Philippines.
Yeah, the Battle of Manila. You can look on the date of his news release that Manila has been liberated is actually the day before American troops even reached the city, February 2nd, 1945. So he goes ahead and declares the city liberated before we actually enter the city. And it was a trend that he did throughout the Pacific, and it used to infuriate his generals because a lot of times these battles were far from won and they hadn't even begun, and what would lie ahead was a lot of violence and a lot of fighting and a lot of bloodshed.
One of the things you point out very vividly is once he makes that announcement, the American media quit worrying about Manila and the Philippines. Mm-hmm. A reporter can actually be on the ground in downtown Manila and report, send it back. And one of his colleagues who's back at headquarters says, oh, everything's beautiful, you know, hunky-dory, kumbaya, and all of that. And that's what gets printed. The real story either is spiked or
buried on page 12.
With the obituaries and the social page.
And that's exactly what happened. You know, MacArthur kept his headquarters about 60 miles out of the city. And so, you know, he would be releasing these daily communiques saying, you know, here's how great everything's gone and whatnot. And the reporter out there would literally just, you know, copy it almost verbatim and send it in, while the reporter looking at the city as it's on fire and the fighting and everything else, you know, their copy gets shoehorned to the very back. And it created a lot of frustration. You know, if you look in the diaries of some of the reporters that were there, not only did that happen, but they also found that when they would be telling their editors, for instance, that, hey, I've got this great story coming out of Manila, they'd say, well, but MacArthur already said Manila's won. Why do we need that? You know, it's that battle's over. So it really it made it hard to get the news of what was going on out.
It also made it difficult for his subordinates on the ground. Mm-hmm. And as the battle for Manila raged, I would say their rage grew, mm-hmm. because MacArthur couldn't understand why they hadn't made progress. He was actually planning a victory parade.
Oh, yes.
Down the Great Esplanade.
Right past his old house. He was going to take it right back to Manila hotels.
Okay. All right. The battle for Manila lasted how long? How many days?
29 days.
All right. 29 days. And on the second day, no, actually before they got, mm-hmm. there, he made the announcement, Manila's won.
Correct.
He does make an initial trip, mm-hmm. to the edge of Manila. And he can't see why they haven't just crossed the river, which bisects the town, mm-hmm. Why the general isn't doing more, why his troops aren't doing more.
Well, and it's interesting, too. You know, there's a real reluctance from his senior commanders. And if you read in their diaries and whatnot, you know, what they were cabling him about what was going on was far different than what they were actually seeing and writing in their diaries. I mean, for instance, you know, he's sending out invitations to a senior officer saying, I want you in Jeep 5 for the liberation parade. And, you know, Eichelberger, for instance, writes back, you know, hey, that sounds great. I'll be honored. And in the meantime, in his diary, he's writing, you know, the city's all on fire right now. I'm 50 miles south of the city. I can see the flames from here. So there's this huge disconnect from what his senior commanders are actually telling him of what's going on versus what they're seeing. And you see that in their communications to MacArthur and in their personal diaries.
All right. And the two major subordinates are Eichelberger and Chase, right?
Yeah. Chase is the one who leads them in. And then you also have Oscar Griswold, who's there as well. So a number of senior field generals that are there. And
yes.
Before the battle actually starts and they're getting there, they're starting to get reports coming from Filipino guerrillas out of the city that the Japanese have begun fortifying Manila. They're building pillboxes, they're fortifying buildings and things like that. And MacArthur's absolutely convinced that the Japanese are going to do just what he did, and that is abandon the city, that it doesn't have much of a military value and they're going to get out. And even though the intelligence is telling him otherwise, and so he actually says at one point, he says he pulls one of his officers aside and he says, let me tell you, he says, there have only been three great intelligence officers in history. And mine is not one of them. And so he chose to go with his gut instinct over what his intelligence was telling him.
All right. Let's take a minute out and look at the Japanese, mm-hmm. side and for our listeners. Mm-hmm. You've got an admiral who ends up being commanding the defenses, mm-hmm. of the city. And then you've got a rather famous or infamous Japanese general who is the overall Filipino, mm-hmm. commander.
Yeah. You've got Japanese General Tomoyuki Yamashita is sort of the senior commander for all of the Philippines. And he had gained a lot of fame early in the war when he seized Singapore from the British and he earned the nickname the Tiger of Malaya.
Okay. Singapore was Britain's Gibraltar in the east, supposedly.
Exactly. And it was a huge British naval base that was really the crown jewel of their overseas possession. And Yamashita was able to steal it from them with a force the third the size of the British defenders and did it in less than 2 months.
And General Yamashita becomes a national hero, but then
he has this rivalry with War Minister Hideki Tojo, and Tojo's consolidating power or whatnot, and he views Yamashita as a threat. And so what he does after Singapore is he sends him off to Manchuria, essentially to guard the wall against a potential Russian invasion, which was never going to happen because the Japanese and the Russians had signed a neutrality pact. But it really got Yamashita sort of out of sight, out of mind. And so he spends the majority of the war up there in the hinterlands until 1944, when the Americans take the Mariana Islands, which is Guam, Saipan, and Tinian. And we're going to use those then as the bases in which to attack the Japanese home islands. And as a result of that defeat, Tojo loses his job and is ousted. And then Yamashita is then resurrected at that point. And he's sent to the Philippines to sort of bog down MacArthur, to stop the American advance north toward the Japanese mainland. And it's the type of fight that Yamashita is really good at. And what he does is rather than fight for the city, he decides he is going to pull his troops out of Manila and he's going to use the landscape just like he did in Singapore against the Americans. And by that, he's going to go out into the jungles and the mountains. And he's going to fight a protracted guerrilla war and try to slow the Americans down and make the Americans come and hunt him.
And he did slow them down.
He did. He did. In fact, he made it all the way till the end of the war and still had about 50,000 troops under him by the time the war ended.
It's clear from his own records that he knew this in many ways was futile, that Japan had already lost the war.
And he assumed he was going to die. He assumed he was being sent to his death.
But the ferocity with which the Japanese defended the Philippines, this was their last stand, and it was no holds barred.
It was. And so what happened is Yamashita had, there was a lower-level naval officer, a Rear Admiral Sanji Iwabuchi, who commanded about 17,000 troops. And his job was to blow up the warehouses and the port facilities in Manila and then also to escape after all that was destroyed. And what happens is he disobeys those orders and chooses rather than escape, he wants to stay in Manila and turn it into an urban quagmire, much like Stalingrad for the
which he did.
And so he then orders his forces to fortify the city. And so they began barricading intersections. They use improvised explosive devices like what we see in Iraq. They booby-trapped dead animals, dead bodies. They went inside big, heavy concrete government buildings that were designed to withstand typhoons and earthquakes, and they barricaded the passageways to try to slow the American advance through the buildings. They used railroad axles sunk into the asphalt to create tank traps at major intersections, and they even went so far as to booby-trap graveyards. I mean, all designed to just slow the Americans and sort of, you know, create this huge quagmire.
All right, we're talking about the Japanese fortifying Manila, and you've got some diagrams and guerrillas in Manila who were on America's side were sending messages out. They're putting pillboxes at intersections, and almost every major intersection there were pillboxes, as you mentioned, tank traps. And when the information was getting back to the Americans, they weren't believing it.
Correct. Well, a lot of the intelligence officers were. It was MacArthur who was the one who said, you know, oh, that's all rubbish. You know, they're gonna vacate the city and whatnot. And no sooner do the Americans reach Manila than they realize that that is exactly what the Japanese planned to do, which was to fight this protracted battle in the city.
Well, as the Americans reach the city, the Japanese begin to destroy it.
Correct. Yeah, the first objective for the Americans was to reach the University of Santo Tomas, which was the big internment camp. And it's kind of up on the northern side of the city. And that's where 3,700 Americans, you know, men, women, and children, civilians were. So the Americans roll in and head straight to the internment camp. And they arrive there about 6:30 p.m. that night on February 3rd, 1945. You know, and it's a huge celebration. I mean, euphoria. These are internees who are nearly starved to death. In fact, they were starving to death at a rate of 3 to 4 a day by the time the Americans arrived. That same day that the Americans reached the city, Iwabuchi's forces begin to destroy the northern suburbs. And they're using gasoline to set buildings on fire. They're using bombs to blow up buildings and things like that. And really just to destroy the city and then fall back across the river into central Manila, where they had really planned their big, massive final stand. And that's exactly what they did, you know. And they were really creative. I mean, they took, you know, Japanese ships that had been sunk in air raids during the lead up to the Battle of Manila. They went out and harvested the guns off of those so that they could reuse them. They took, you know, beach mines and turned them into improvised explosive devices. So there was a lot of creativity in how to sort of recycle ordnance and guns for use in this battle.
You say they're starting in the northern suburbs. As they retreat, they destroy whether it's commercial,
residential. I mean, they really just burn up much of it. And then they fall back across the river and blow up all the major bridges across. They essentially force the Americans are going to then in order to have to cross the river. And it's not a huge river, but it's a fast-moving, muddy river with a lot of sight lines. So they're going to make it very dangerous for the Americans to have to come across by boat. But again, it's all designed to slow down the Americans. And central Manila is where all the big government buildings and the old walled city, the ancient Spanish citadel with stone walls was located. And that's where they really had planned to make their final stand.
Right. And how are the Japanese treating the civilians as they withdraw?
Brutally. And what happens in Manila is truly, it's one of the worst human catastrophes of World War II. It's very comparable to the rape of Nanking, which was in 1937, 1938, when the Japanese took the Chinese capital. And they killed, you know, an estimated 250,000, 300,000 civilians. I mean, they killed so many of them that the Yangtze River turned red, according to accounts. And so it was really just a vengeance executed against civilians, you know, non-combatants. And what happened there in 37 and 38 is really bookended by what happens in Manila at the end of the war in February 1945, when the Japanese go on a rampage and began killing men, women, and children in Manila. I mean, and they kill them in very brutal, horrific ways.
Bayoneting a lot.
There's a lot of bayoneting. There's a lot of use of sabers. They locked people inside buildings and set them on fire. They took St. Paul's College, for instance, which was a school there, and they took all the surrounding residents and they packed them all into the dining hall there, and they'd rigged the chandeliers with explosives. And so when it was filled with, you know, hundreds of nearby neighbors, they detonated the lights, and it killed 360 men, women, and children there.
As they're going through residential neighborhoods, some Filipinos, particularly in the wealthier neighborhoods, they had bomb shelters, mm-hmm. what have you, and if the Japanese found it, they just dumped gasoline in the—
Oh, yes. They threw hand grenades inside bomb shelters. They threw Molotov cocktails and set people on fire. I mean, really, people were hiding under houses, sort of in the crawl spaces under houses or under the ruins of houses, and they would pull people out from under there and shoot them or bayonet them. I mean, they really – it was a systematic, organized destruction. I mean, you had these troops literally going block by block trying to round up civilians and kill them. And they went so far, even in one area, is to plant a Red Cross flag in the middle of a big empty lot, thinking that would lure people out as a safe haven, and then they could grab them there. They even attacked the Red Cross headquarters, you know, which was filled with refugees who had gone there to escape the artillery and the fires, and went in there and killed everybody there.
Nearby was the German Club.
Mm-hmm. Manila had a sizable German population, and that was their social hall.
And they tried to explain that they were allies.
Yeah, the Germans were allied with Japan, and none of it mattered. And so what happened is the German Club was a big stone structure. And during this time, the Americans were using artillery in the city, and the Japanese were setting everything on fire. So the city was really kind of being destroyed from the inside and the out. And so residents would flee toward these large concrete structures that would offer them shelter. That also happened to have big yards that served as fire breaks. And the German Club was one of those. And so you literally had hundreds of residents, and they had gone – a lot of the buildings in Manila, because it's kind of at a floodplain, are elevated, so they're big crawl spaces. So literally hundreds of people had gone underneath these crawl spaces for extra protection. And so what the Japanese did is they came out one morning and they took all these suitcases and bags of parcels that people had brought, and they piled them all around the openings of these where the crawl space openings were, and they covered them with gasoline. And then they went inside the club above and they piled up all the furniture. And in the Philippines, they use a lot of wicker furniture, so it's very flammable. And they doused all that with gasoline and set it on fire. So the club was literally burning overhead of all these refugees. And then their entrance, their exits from the crawl space were all blocked by flaming suitcases and things like that. So literally over 500 people died that day at the German Club. And it's, you know, the German Club is still hallowed ground in Manila today. It's still an empty lot. No one in the 74 years since then has built on that property.
You mentioned the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually the building was burned, but not before it had been attacked.
And the Japanese Marines came in through the back door, and they went room by room, shooting and bayoneting the people, including, you know, children, infants, people that were on an operating room table there in the Red Cross. I mean, no one was spared. One of the more gruesome things they did, and the atrocities in Manila, the Americans ultimately determined there were 27 major atrocities in Manila, and a lot of them had unique characteristics. I mean, the Japanese were – there was a lot of creativity and sort of thought put into how to do this, like rigging chandeliers at St. Paul's College. But in one of the more gruesome crimes, they took a house, and they went up to the second floor of this house, and they went into one of the big rooms there, and they cut a hole in the floor. And then they rounded up all the males in this neighborhood right around it, and they would march them in blindfolded one at a time up the stairs to the second floor into this room and make them kneel with their head over this hole. And then a Marine with his sword would cut the individual's head off so that the head would fall down in the hole, while the guy behind him would then kick the body so the body then tumbled into the first floor, down in the hole into the first floor below. Well, they filled up this entire downstairs. And American war crimes investigators ultimately, by counting skulls, determined that 200 men had died inside
now,
this
some
house.
Individuals survived, which is how the story became part of the trial.
Nine people miraculously survived that. And the reason they survived is, to be honest, I mean, and this is gruesome, but it's really difficult to cut someone's head off with a sword and to do it repetitively time and time again with that level of accuracy and the strength needed to wield a sword enough to cut bone. And so what happened is a lot of the people who survived had these gaping wounds, a lot of them sort of in the thick muscle at the base of the neck. So nine of these folks survived. The Americans photographed them all afterwards. Some of the pictures, of course, of their wounds are in the book. And then they ultimately testified against Yamashita in the war crimes trial. But think of that kind of brutality. I mean, that's the thing that happened in Manila is just that
well, it makes you wonder. It was not something that the chandeliers, for example, mm-hmm.
that takes forethought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the bombs, even the gas, that's fairly traditional mm-hmm. urban warfare. People don't like to think about it, but it is.
Yeah.
Also, organized rape.
Mm-hmm. They did that exactly. They took the Bayview Hotel, which is still in existence today. It's still right there on the bay.
The same building?
Same building. And it's still called the Bayview. I mean, they've redone it and all, yeah. but it's still there. And so the Bayview Hotel, the Japanese went out and rounded up literally hundreds and hundreds of women and brought them there and essentially turned this hotel into a brothel and to enforced all these women to have sex with troops. And it's still, you know, a very, very brutal part of that battle.
We need to pause for a moment, James, and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with James Scott about his recent book, Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila. So once they get to us in the central city, mm-hmm. and you've got these wonderful American-built buildings, mm-hmm. by the way, reinforced concrete.
Oh, yes.
And it's not just what they've done, the bunkers on the street corners. The Japanese are using high-rises as sniper locations, mm-hmm. what have you.
Dropping Molotov cocktails.
So mm-hmm. the Americans begin to shell the city.
Mm-hmm. They do. And I'll tell you, originally MacArthur had refused to allow, during the battle, planes to bomb the city or artillery because of the risk to civilians. Because there were so many civilians inside the city. And so, but after the Americans suffered heavy casualties trying to get it across the river and get into central Manila, he relented and he allowed yeah. artillery.
Well, his commanders initially wanted to use air power, and mm-hmm. he absolutely forbid that.
He did, and he refused air power throughout the whole battle, but he did allow them to use artillery. And so American troops over the course of the battle would fire about 42,000 artillery rounds into the city. 27,000 of those from big guns too, and so there were a lot of folks died, you know, from because the Japanese, you know, would actually hole up with the civilians. So, for instance, at the Philippines General Hospital, you had 7,000 refugees there, and you had lots of Japanese troops there too, and so it created a lot of confusion for the American artillery teams when they're trying to locate where the Japanese are, and you know, the Japanese are firing artillery back from positions that should be off limits, like hospitals. So you did have a lot of civilians killed and injured through the artillery as well. And yet for MacArthur's troops, it's important to remember that they were really used to jungle warfare up until this point. I mean, they were used to storming beaches in New Guinea and fighting in the jungles. And here, the landscape is entirely different. So now they're having to learn how to fight, you know, building by building, room by room. And they very quickly learned that one of the most dangerous and one of the best weapons to use was the flamethrower. And that you could get into a building and that you could very quickly light up any Japanese that were in there. But they also had to learn lessons on the fly. Like, for instance, flamethrowers can ricochet in close quarters. And they can also suck up all the oxygen in a room. And so, you know, but that became one of the best weapons used by the American troops. They ended up in one of the more interesting battles during this time was for Rizal Hall, which is a big several-story building at the University of the Philippines. And the Americans, you know, they would fire artillery and just really decimate the outsides of the buildings. And then they would send in these assault troops, these 12-man teams basically to go in there and get the Japanese. Well, the Japanese were fanatical about holding these buildings. And so the battle for Rizal Hall stretched on for 2 days. And finally, at the end of the second day, with the Americans and the Japanese were both up on the second floor. And you have to remember, this building's a wasteland inside at this point. There are gaping holes in the walls and in the floors and things like that. But neither side would give in. And so that night, as the day is fading into dusk, and all the Americans and the Japanese both decide they're going to hunker down inside this building together And of course, there's no electricity. So the Americans are sitting there all night listening, you know, their fingers on the triggers of their rifles, and the Japanese just a few rooms away, wondering who's going to attack who throughout the night. In about the middle of the night, they start hearing the Japanese singing on the opposite side of the building. And they're listening. And that singing builds up into a crescendo, followed by explosions of grenades and what sounds like dynamite. And this goes on. This more singing, more explosions, more silence. And it goes all the way on until 4 o'clock in the morning. The Americans are listening. Finally, at that point, a lasting silence settles over the building. Well, at daylight, when they can finally see, the Americans move in and they discover that 77 Japanese Marines had blown themselves up while they had listened to them the night before. So that gives you a sense of just that ferocious urban warfare with these two enemies trapped inside a building together. I mean, how terrifying must that have been?
Well, and in the case of the Manila Hotel, the Americans had taken it.
Mm-hmm.
But overnight, the Japanese came back in.
Took it back.
Took it back.
Yeah.
And made sure that they blew up MacArthur's apartment.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and that's the thing. MacArthur had to leave so fast. You know, he evacuates at the beginning of the war so fast that and he's got this palatial home there. His wife has to reduce the contents of the family's home into just two suitcases. So when MacArthur comes back, he wants to go back to his house. He wants his stuff back. And he gets there, you know, and literally just as the Japanese come back into the Manila Hotel and firebomb his home. And he literally gets up there and it's just all been destroyed. There's a dead Japanese colonel on the floor of his house. But his whole home, all his possessions, I mean, gone were all his books, gone were his father's Civil War medals, gone was his son Arthur's baby book. All the things they had left behind, totally destroyed.
And you've got a number of quotations, how devastated he is. And I mean, he goes on about this for several days, and they're Filipinos who've lost everything.
And that's important to remember about this battle is the human cost wasn't, I mean, it was born across multiple generations. So you had families where the grandparents might have been killed or the parents killed or even the children killed. And that's why from the human cost, the Battle of Manila still really echoes through all these people's lives 75 years later. You also had massive property destruction, 613 blocks flattened, an area that contained 11,000 buildings.
And when you say literally flattened, it was?
It's flattened. Oh, it totally was flattened and destroyed. And and it was so flattened that you didn't even know where the roads had once been,
but,
or the sidewalks.
Hey, isn't the old Spanish citadel back? But that's been rebuilt. It was actually...
It's been rebuilt. It sat, the old Spanish walled city, it sat fallow until the 1970s, filled with squatters. And they've realized in Manila what a great tourism draw it is now. It's kind of like downtown Charleston, this old walled city. And so you go there now and there are rickshaws that'll take you around and carriages. And it's been rebuilt. There's a Starbucks there. I mean, it's coming back. But for years, it sat empty.
But the American presence in terms of physical structures was literally obliterated during the...
Pretty much. I mean, most of the places the Japanese holed up in were things like the legislature and the finance building, the big government buildings that were really the symbols of American power and influence in the Philippines. These were the big neoclassical buildings that we had built that ultimately were the ones that the Japanese holed up in and that we destroyed. I mean, we fired artillery at point-blank range straight into these buildings and wrecked them.
So how does the battle end?
There was never a doubt that America would ultimately prevail because we had more firepower and more troops. The question really was how long would the Japanese hold out and what would the civilian and property damage end up being? And it was extreme. Of the 17,000 Japanese troops there, 16,665 were killed. Yeah, so just a few hundred survived. And most of those that survived were left on the battlefield for dead because the Japanese had orders to kill anyone who was wounded. About 100,000 civilians were killed either through atrocities, massacres by the Japanese or through artillery fire or just the burning of buildings by the Japanese. The Americans, we had a little over 1,000 killed and about 5,500 wounded, so high casualties on our side as well. And the battle ends finally with Iwabuchi and the last of his forces inside a couple of these buildings that we pounded with artillery and then went in and eliminated the last few troops. And those that were hiding out in the tunnels underneath, we either bulldozed them shut and left them down there to suffocate or burned them out.
Well, now, there are Japanese officers who were tried after the war, mm-hmm. and I think most Americans through Hollywood and other histories think, well, the Japanese commander is going to commit seppuku rather than surrender.
And Yamashita didn't. You know, Yamashita actually stayed in the mountains. I mean, MacArthur and the American forces hunted him for the rest of the war. And finally, when the war ends and the Japanese surrender, he walks out of the jungle. He's still in command of about 50,000 troops, and he surrenders and is promptly arrested.
So once Manila was captured, you still have a large Japanese army.
Up in the northern part of Luzon, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, what about the admiral?
Iwabuchi actually killed himself. He was inside the agricultural building, and with the last 700 troops he had still fighting in the city, and he knew he was doomed. He was surrounded. And so he apologized to his troops for leading them to doom, and he committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And then his body was never found in all the rubble and whatnot. So, but he died, and along with literally the majority of all his forces inside the city.
All right. So what happened after?
What happens after is Yamashita comes out of the jungles, and he's promptly surrenders and is promptly arrested. And he's brought back to Manila, to the scene of the crime, to stand trial as the first war criminal in all of Asia. Mm-hmm. And he's put on trial in the old high commissioner's home right in downtown Manila, right by the Manila Hotel. And it's now the U.S. Embassy in the ballroom there. And that ballroom still exists. And he was given American attorneys to defend him. And there was an American prosecution team and a panel of five judges who would preside over his fate. And so he was put on trial in the fall of 1945. 16,000 spectators turned out over the course of the 32-day trial to watch. And the Battle of Manila was really replayed in a courtroom. They brought in over 286 witnesses. These were folks who'd survived the massacre at the German Club or in the house I told you about where they had cut off all the heads. And these people testified about what had happened during the Battle of Manila. And it was a very dramatic trial, as you can imagine. It was also videoed. You can actually go to the National Archives and watch witnesses.
Actually,
watch
well, probably film. I mean,
film, yeah, it's yeah, film.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, get back to an earlier medium.
Yeah, yeah. But you can actually go to the National Archives and you can watch the witnesses testify about it.
The general and how many of the officers were hanged?
Yeah, Yamashita, now he blamed it all. He blamed everything that happened in Manila on Iwabuchi, on his subordinate. Even though there was evidence that he was in contact with Iwabuchi throughout the Battle of Manila and could have intervened to stop it had he wanted to, he was ultimately found guilty. He appealed his case all the way to the United States Supreme Court and lost. And then he was hanged in February of 1946. His chief of staff, Akira Muto, who had also played a role in the rape of Nanking, was also hanged. Out of all the – there was only one other senior commander from the Battle of Manila that was found alive, and he had sort of led some of the troops on the far southern part of the city outside some of the worst fighting. And he had initially pled not guilty, and then he changed his plea to guilty a day or two in. And as a result of sparing the Philippines in a trial, he was rather than hang them, they sentenced him to death by firing squad.
But now some of the officers who were convicted were later pardoned by the president of the Philippines.
Correct, yes. And that was a very controversial move. But President Quirino, who had actually been a senator during the time of the Battle of Manila and had several of his family members machine gunned by the Japanese during the battle, he in the early 1950s thought that with Japan and the Philippines being neighbors and the need to be able to depend on your neighbors, that having so many Japanese locked up inside Filipino prisons was problematic. And so he made the decision to pardon everybody and send them all home. You know, some of these folks were people who'd been awaiting execution. And so they were sent back to Japan.
There was one quote from William Dunn, a CBS News correspondent, who'd actually been in Manila when it fell and then was repatriated, but was back literally in the thick of it. He was one of those reporters. He was telling what was really happening. He said, "The Manila of 1941 was a unique Manila. A Manila that had never existed before, a Manila that would never exist again."
Yeah, I think that quote, and that's why I used it as the pull quote at the top of the epilogue, because I think that perfectly sums up what this battle did. I mean, Manila was this amazing city, the Pearl of the Orient, and it was totally, over the course of its 29 days, totally destroyed. Totally wrecked. And rather than rebuild, what actually happened is the Philippines really went just south of Manila, and there's now a brand new city, Makati. And that's where all the glass high-rises and steel high-rises are, the international department stores and the banks. And Manila really kind of languished for decades after that.
The United States granted the Philippines independence in 1946 and just left them with what was left of Manila.
Exactly. And so, yeah, the Philippines have really struggled. And, you know, I talked to friends I know who are Foreign Service officers who served in Manila, and, you know, they you know, a lot of speculation, and there was actually a letter in one of the Filipino newspapers this week that so much of the strife and the political turmoil and social unrest that have been in the Philippines in the last 70 years really grow out of this one battle and the total destruction. I mean, you saw under the Japanese occupation, you saw the moral fabric in the Philippines really unravel as starvation took hold. People were forced to sell children and abandon them. Then you saw the total destruction of the city. And so, you know, those two things, the occupation and the destruction of the city, really planted the seeds of the problems that now have really grown to dominate, you know, life in Manila today, 75 years later.
Well, what about how Filipinos today feel about the Japanese?
Yeah, and, you know, like with so many things, there's, of course, a generational divide. You know, for folks who are older, who, you know, maybe grew up, were children during the Battle of Manila, or who lost parents during the Battle of Manila, there's still a lot of, I mean, this battle still haunts their lives. For younger generations, you know, those who, are children now, teenagers now, in their 30s now, you know, it's history. And so I'm actually going back over there next month, and I'm going to speak. I'm doing a whole university lecture series at different schools there as part of a way to sort of remind the younger generation about their history and about what this battle did.
All right. James, Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. I'm sorry. What's your next book?
I'm working on a book on the March 1945 firebombing of Tokyo, which was the most destructive raid in World War II history. Burned up 16 square miles of Tokyo, killed 104,000 people, more people than died at Dresden, more people than initially died at Hiroshima. And it was a huge change of plans and tactics for the Americans, because up until that point, we had really made an effort to use pinpoint strategic bombing. But when those things weren't working over Japan, General Curtis LeMay switched gears and said, rather than go after the factories, we'll go after the neighborhoods where the factory workers live.
So. Okay. Well, James Scott, the author of Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila, I want to thank you for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you learned something from today's journal. It's a sobering story, but an important one, and James Scott tells it well, and it's a story that still resonates in the Far East today. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.